Friends, very nice to see you all this evening. I'm Helena Kennedy and I'm the principal here at Mansfield College. And as you know, we have a special thing here at Mansfield, which is that we have the Friday night series of talks and lectures. We're very lucky that we have tonight with us Bob Marshall-Andrews. Queen's Counsel, was a Member of Parliament from 1997 to 2010, where he was Member of Parliament for Medway, Labour representative there. I know you all laugh because this series was also sort of known as Friends of the Principal, and it's true to say that Bob Marshall-Andrews is a friend of the Principal, and in fact I was reminding him that we met first, and well, I knew him because he was a glamorous person at the bar when I first started as a pupil. And my pupil master was standing for Parliament, and he was standing in Luton, and he was gathering together people who might go and canvass for him. And so I volunteered, as a good pupil would, to go and canvass for him in Luton. And met on the platform of the station Bob Marshall-Andrews, looking like Che Guevara. He had a kind of Zapata moustache at that time. And my memory is that he had a fedora, and he was very kind of larger than life. And he and I went up and pressed ourselves upon the good folk of Luton.
We won.
And we won. It was against the odds. Our man got in, and so that was how our friendship started, and of course we have been friends since, and particularly became very good friends when we were both there in the Houses of Parliament at different ends of the corridor, but often making common cause. So it's great for me to be introducing him here tonight. But Bob is something more than somebody who's a parliamentarian. And he was an enormous success at the bar, one of the great advocates at the English bar, and still is. And it was kind of came as a surprise to everybody that he decided, at the top of his career, to stand for Parliament. I mean, people were really taken aback. And partly we didn't know how you were going to deal with drop in salary. And so we all thought, what's he thinking about? And he came into the House, and we all thought, well, he'll be the Attorney General or something. He obviously must be coming in with another set of intentions. However, not a bit of it. He came in and became the great gallant who took on government on the whole issue of civil liberties, and did so with such humour and wit that he became beloved in Parliament and really was able to rise above the brickbats of normal politics. And he really was one of those people who refreshed us about politics and made us believe that you could be an authentic person who was not on message, who did not answer every call on that thing that people were given, to advising them of what the line was. The line did not figure in the world of Bob Marshall-Andrews. And so he was a very interesting and, I thought, very, very successful politician. True, principled, and really he made it all so much more fun. So it's great to see him here tonight, but there are many more things I can tell you about him. He's written a number of novels. He wrote a wonderful sort of memoir of his time in Parliament recently, which was hilarious, in which he also, unfortunately, told a story about how we raised money before it all started, we got a lot of people into trouble, particularly ourselves. But he's done lots of interesting and important things. Environmentally, he's done a lot of work in the developing world. He still travels to hard parts of the world to talk about the importance of an independent legal profession, an independent judiciary, and so on. But he's here in all his glory tonight to talk to us. Thank you for coming to Mansfield.
Thank you, Helena. Thank you very much for that. May I say straight away that it is an enormous
privilege and honour to be a friend of the principal's, and particularly when I look at the glittering cast that she has assembled before me, and I'm very flattered to have been asked. Politicians are easily flattered. We are incorrigibly vain, not Helena, but all the rest of us, are something that was brought home to me forcibly immediately after the 2005 election, which I won with a staggering majority of 213. And immediately after the election, I went to Paris for the weekend in order to look after the interests of my constituents, well, one of them anyway, and as I was in the taxi, as we were in the taxi going to Heathrow, I could see that the taxi driver was looking at me quizzically in the mirror from time to time, and as we got to the Heathrow turning, he opened the slide and he said, all right, Gov, give us a clue. And I said, well, I said, I'm a politician, I'm a backbencher, but I'm quite often on the television, on the radio, talking about issues like civil liberties, war. I said, I write articles in the national press and I scribbled the old book. I said, I suspect that's it. And he said, thank you. Which terminal? Things went badly from that point onwards. Here I am, and I'm very grateful to be here, enormously privileged, as I say. The title of my talk is A Political Lamentation. Why is it a lamentation? I had a wonderful time in Parliament, as Helena said, and I have enormous respect for it as an institution, but it is a lamentation because, and she's already underscored this when she started, since 1997, we have seen in parliamentary terms the biggest serial attack on civil liberties, which has taken place in this country since the government of Lord Liverpool in the 19th century, reflected and immortalised in Percy Bysshe's great verse, The Mask of Anarchy. The Labour government was more responsible for this than anything else, and the Labour government between 1997 and 2010 passed more criminal justice legislation than was passed in the whole of the 19th century, which is going some. It was liberal, indeed it was repressive. For the first time for 800 years, British subjects could be locked up indefinitely, without trial. Judges were not asked or given, but they were forced to pass indeterminate sentences, which they still do. They have no choice, and as a result, our prison system is grotesquely overcrowded, and, as we know, on the permanent verge of dangerous mutiny. That is a legacy about which you do not hear much from Alistair Campbell, who at the moment, I gather, is giving a lecture on civil liberties at Cambridge. That will surprise Helena. All of this maelstrom of legislation was taking place at a time when crime was falling, steadily falling from year to year. And the result of that, if you reducted ad absurdum, you would arrive at a point when there were crimes were so many and the crimes that were committed so few that everybody would have their own personalised crime which they could carry around with them for the rest of their life. And it was a process which continued. Why? Why did we arrive at this unhappy state? And does it matter? That's the first thing. Does it matter at all? Has it affected us? It matters in my respectful submission to you. It matters terribly. It is not just simply the loss of liberty, because the loss of liberty, let's face it, does not affect many people. It is not the physical loss of liberty. Liberty to us is far, far greater than simply a number of bolt-on rights that you achieve from a constitutional contract. Liberty in this country is our defining characteristic as a nation, and we need to remember it. It is part of our philosophical and cultural background. we understand as a matter of philosophy in this country that you will never reduce the sum total of human wickedness by reducing the sum total of human liberty. Never. Of course, in repressive regimes such as Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, you can create a state in which the penalties are so great, the punishment so severe, that you will reduce the number of crimes that are committed. But you do so only by, at the expense of a more or less algebraic equation, of transferring wickedness from the citizen to the state. Now, we have always understood that as a point of principle. And thus, when we attack civil liberties, we are not just simply attacking our liberties, we are attacking our very identity. And it's our identity as a nation. So yes, yes, it matters. Now, how did we get into this terrible state that we were in for that 13 years, and to a certain extent still are? The Labour Party, which was always the party, which quite rightly prided itself as being the repository, the political repository of civil liberty. That's why I joined it, that's why Helena joined it, that's why many people did. And that background of civil liberty in the Labour Party owed itself to trade union emancipation on the one hand, and to a Bloomsbury liberalism and a respect for human rights on the other. And those two things came together in the Labour Party, our own particular brand of socialism, and powerful they were indeed. So what happened? What happened to the Labour Party, which turned it into the most repressive piece of political machinery for 150 years? Well, it's an interesting reflection. What happened was this. Before the 1970s, and this may surprise you, it certainly surprised me, before the 1970s, no manifesto of any major political party contained anything on law and order and crime. Nothing before the 1970s. And of course, the manifestos contained many things which we said indeed did affect the level of crime, health, housing, poverty, all of those. But crime itself and the responsibility for the commission of crime and the amount of crime was absent from any manifesto. And the reason was there was a tacit agreement among politicians that human venality was a matter for theology and not for politics. Now, all of that changed in the 1970s. And the Tories perceived, and it was clever in the extreme, they perceived in the Labour Party a compassion for the sinner could very easily be portrayed as approbation for the sin. And to being soft on crime and criminals was an albatross that they hung cleverly and beautifully around the emaciated neck of the Labour Party, which was shortly to lose power for nearly a quarter of a century. And it was an enormously powerful weapon. It was a populist weapon. It was a populist weapon because a rise in the popular press, and the Murdoch press in particular, took it up with gusto and abandoned. More of that in a moment. But it was an enormously powerful weapon. Now, the New Labour project, which was the mastermind of Mr. Peter Manson, Mr. Gordon Brown, Mr. Tony Blair, the New Labour project realised this very clearly. And what they did as part of the project was they attempted to ambush and to outflank the Tories on civil liberty and crime and punishment. And they did it by a repeated and serious attack on liberty, not on crime itself, but on liberty. And thereby, of course, committing the first fallacy to which I've already referred, namely that a removal of liberty is itself a removal of human wickedness. Now, why? Why did that succeed? Well, for two reasons. Firstly, those who were in charge of the Labour Party at the time were natural authoritarians. David Blunkett, natural authoritarian. Tony Blair, natural authoritarian. So they came to the right place. But also, there was the populist drive which underpins parliamentary democracy. And that is something that I want to talk about because that is in itself a danger and which allowed us to get into the position that we are. But the result of it is that we have seen a Dutch auction in liberties. And so every time Labour put into effect populist repressive legislation, it was trumped or attempted to be trumped by the Tories. Now, How did that come about? Let me say that after this dire beginning, I'm going to cheer you up. not the first thing I can say to you, it could have been immeasurably worse. And it would have been immeasurably worse, apart from a number of things that happened, one of whom is sitting on my right here, and that is the mistress of Mansfield. As she is indeed is now, Baroness Kennedy of the Shires in the House of Lords, and for a period of time, Helena and I ran what I think, I'll tell you this now, a fairly impressive double act in Parliament. I fomented revolution and rebellion on the Labour backbenches. We had such huge majorities we could never beat the government, or very, very rarely beat the government in the Commons, but we reduced their majority to such an extent that in the Lords, Baroness Kennedy, Shires could stand up and make a speech to her fellow peers and say, this is not the will of the people, this is the will of the whips. Because look at the majority in the House of Commons has been reduced from 130 to 43. And so we provided for each other the meeting that we had, and we were successful. We were successful on a number of things. One of them, jury trial. The repeated attacks on the principle and the existence of jury trial was one of the hallmarks of the early Labour government. And it forms the basis of an interesting story that I can tell you about the then Home Secretary, Sir Jack Straw, a man I've known for many, many years, and who, despite what I'm going to tell you now, still remains a friend of mine. and of course, what I'm going to tell you involves confidences which came from the then Lord Chief Justice, and indeed from Jack himself, from his office. And as this is a public meeting, I can tell you that the Chatham House rules apply, and if you want to repeat this story, you will require my express permission to do so, and let me say straight away, you have it. one of the early attacks on jury trial was a little bill called the Mode of Trial Bill. Came to be the Mode of Trial Bill then came to be known as Mode of Trial Bill 1 for reasons which I will explain to you. This odious little piece of legislation removed the right to elect trial by jury. Very serious offences, you would still have to be tried by a jury, but for the vast majority of cases, the right to elect jury trial was removed from you, and it was replaced by magistrates deciding whether you got jury trial or not. And, of course, that would effectively have meant that jury trial would wither in the branch over a period of time. You'd have more professional magistrates would be appointed who would take on more cases themselves, and effectively, and this was undoubtedly the view of the Home Office, undoubtedly jury trial would become, apart from murder and offences such as that kind, a memory. So, Mode of Trial Bill 1, of course, we opposed it, root and branch. And it contained in it what was known as a reputation clause. Bear with me, this is quite interesting. A reputation clause. The reputation clause enjoined magistrates that in deciding whether you got the right to jury trial, they should take into account how serious the offence was, but also the reputation of the defendant standing in front of them. And if the person was a person of great reputation, then they were more likely to get jury trial, and this was in order to deal with the perfectly respectable elderly lady or lady of a certain age who absentmindedly walks out of W. H. Smith's with a Kingsley Amis novel, or Kingsley Amis himself, and walks out forgetting to pay for it, and because of that tiny aberration would lose her very considerable reputation. So that was the reason why it was put in the bill. But of course, it's absolutely odious, because it's what we said, you're creating two-tier justice. There's a justice for those that have a reputation, a justice for those that haven't got a reputation. And the minute you lose your reputation, you not only lose, you go to prison or whatever, but you lose in perpetuity, effectively, your right to be tried, or the likelihood that you will be tried by a jury. And so we said, two-tier justice. And it was a good argument, and we got a big rebellion. 60 Labour MPs voted against it, and off it went to the House of Lords, where Mistress Mansfield did her work, her magic, on her fellow peers, and the Lords chucked it out. And I still have her speech in which she said that down in the other place, they had a rebellion of 60, and so it was effective and powerful stuff. And they chucked it out. And so Jack Straw had a look at it again, and they brought it back. They brought Mode of Trial Bill 2. Now, Mode of Trial Bill 2 was exactly the same as Mode of Trial Bill 1, but the reputation clause had been taken out. And furthermore, not only did they take the reputation clause out, but there was a clause in it saying that magistrates could not take account of reputation in deciding whether or not somebody was going to have jury trial. Well, of course, that opened up the opportunity of saying, what about the old lady who lived, walked in the mouth and walks up with a copy of King's Amis?
Well, we're advocates.
Yes, I am. Whereupon they shouted foul and said, I said, well, no, not foul at all. It's bad anyway, whichever way you look at it. It is bad. So, but the point of the story is about Jack. And Jack at the dispatch box said to the House of Commons, he said, This legislation enjoys the support of the Association of Police Constables, they would, wouldn't they? The Association of Magistrates, they would, wouldn't they? And also the Lord Chief Justice. So I thought, well, Lord Chief Justice at the time was a great liberal man called Tom Bingham. And so I said, I wonder if that's right. So I wrote to Tom Bingham. Tom is got to know him after that. And said, can I come see you about this?
This is the story that we're not to repeat.
This is the story we're not to repeat. Yes, I said, can I? Well, except whenever you want to. And so I went to see Tom Bingham, and I said, you may not be aware of this, the Home Secretary, I mean, has said that you approve of this legislation. Is that right? And he looked out of the window, wonderful room in the Thames, overlooking the Thames, and he said, I don't really feel at liberty to answer that question. Now, see, I'm not much of a barrister, but I can sense an opening when I see one. So I said, why? And he said, well, he said, I've had correspondence with the Home Secretary, and I'm not sure that I am at liberty to reveal it to you without his consent. So I said, fine, I'll write to Jack and then say that you want his consent and ask him to give it. No reason why he shouldn't give you consent to show me the correspondence. Good, said Tom Bingham. If you would, send me a copy of the letter, which I did. So I wrote to Jack, silence. Big silence. Nothing. And the Act wasn't a very big bill, so it didn't take very long going through the parliamentary process. So it lumbers along, and then it's looking as though it's going to come back for its third reading. And so I wrote to the Home Secretary again and said, look, I want to answer to this. I want to see the correspondence between you and the Lord Chief Justice. And silence. And we arrived at a day on a Friday, and the bill was going to come back in the House on a Tuesday. So I got in touch with Jack's private office, and I said, unless I get a reply to this letter, I shall take it to the press, one broadsheet, one red top. And I told him exactly who I would go to, and you're not prepared to reveal this. So I get a phone call from his private office, from one of his officials, who says, terribly sorry, all my fault. Nothing to do with the Home Secretary at all. It's got a totally overlooked fellow at my desk. And so now he's going to talk to the, going to talk to Tom Bingham over the weekend in order to try and pursue this correspondence. And on the Monday, I got it. And it revealed that 3 days before Jack had stood up and said to the House of Commons, this enjoys the support of the Lord Chief Justice, Tom Bingham had written to him and said, I have very grave concerns about this legislation indeed, which I think may very well cause serious injustice. And he gave a number of reasons why he did. So in other words, it was a black lie. And so I went to the press. On Monday, I went to the press and I said, well, he's totally misled the House of Commons. And so my old friend Tony Bevins, late friend Tony Bevins, who was then political editor of The Independent, and somebody, I can't remember who, on the Mirror, and they said, fine, this is devastating, of course, we will run this on our front pages. And the consequences would have been dire. That afternoon, that night, Concord crashed. And the following day, And the following day, quite rightly, all of the newspapers, including the Independent and the Mirror, were full of nothing else except this enormous tragedy, huge loss of human life and the end of supersonic aviation. And pages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, all of them disappeared completely from the Mirror, and the Independent got a couple of columns below the fold on the ninth page. So that was it. But, of course, it didn't fool Parliament. And when we got back into Parliament, Jack had to stand up and say, look, I'm sorry, I inadvertently misled you, but I said that this enjoys the support of the Lord Chief Justice. I should have said he's completely against it. And so we got an even bigger rebellion, and back it went to the House of Lords, where it fell under Helena's malign gaze, and that was the end of the murder trial bills. So there you are, that's an interesting story. You can tell who you like, vote Labour. But that was, being serious, I mean, just simply an illustration, because one of the methods that was used in order to get this raft of legislation through the House of Commons was deliberate manipulation of the House. Now, you can forget about dodgy dossiers in Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. This was replicated time and time again in the statistics and the figures that were used in order to promote this legislation. Now, the second thing, of course, which was of enormous assistance to those that were hell-bent on this program and this project, was terrorism. Because the fear, the growth of terrorism, is not only the growth of terrorism, it's the growth of fear. And nothing, no weapon is greater for an authoritarian government than fear. And the way in which you promote and you achieve and you are successful in promoting authoritarian legislation is because you say it is necessary because of fear. Fear of terrorism. Now, of course, the terrorist, the intifadas and the like, do not aim to destroy large parts of the infrastructure of great countries, great cities. I mean, bombs are serious, of course they are, but they are pinpricks compared to much other destruction. Of course, loss of life is regrettable and awful, but it is very little, in truth, if you look at the whole of terrorist activities compared to even the smallest of wars that were embarked upon by Mr. Blair and the Labour government, of which more and more, whenever you want. It's not in themselves, but the terrorist, of course, the worst weapon of the terrorist is to persuade you to create your own instabilities, to bring about legislation which affects the liberty of your own people as a result of what the terrorist does. And so, of course, when you bring that legislation forward, you are doing precisely and exactly what they require you or want you to do. And that, unhappily, took place under the Labour government. The attempts, 90 days detention, first of all, control orders, of course, which still, in a truncated form, exist, that is to say, indefinite detention without trial or judicial process, which still exists, were passed under Labour government under the guise of the fear of terrorism. I'm pleased to say that it was legislation which did not get passed in its full glory. One of the reasons for that was a speech in the House of Commons, which any all of us who heard it will remember it. It's in a book that I wrote, and it's one of the very few that I quote verbatim from beginning to end. Barbara Follett, the wife of Ken Follett, Member of Parliament, impeccable Blairite, a totally loyal member of the House of Commons, whose husband was shot in South Africa. He was a Liberal in South Africa. He was put under house arrest under the control orders, which were a replication of the orders that we were passing through Parliament. Replication. They could actually have been lifted from the apartheid laws. And for the only time in Parliament she rebelled against it, that she made a speech in which she told us about the death of her husband, who, having been under house arrest for 4 years, when they could no longer keep him under house arrest, they shot him. And she said, I cannot possibly vote for this legislation. And the effect of that one single speech from a Blairite loyalist was infinitely greater than speeches by me, well-known troublemaker in the House of Commons. And that resulted in that legislation being substantially watered down, but not entirely. 90 days detention without trial came before the House. It was defeated just on a compromise of 28. 42 days they came back subsequently. It was defeated on a compromise of 28, but still 28. And the interesting thing was, and this is now I move on to the press, was the enormous support that the government achieved from the popular press, in particular The Sun and the News of the World. Now, of course, no more. Hooray. Nonetheless, that is where they gleaned their support from. And there were a number of Labour rebels that were going to rebel. I mean, they knew that. We put it down in paper that we were going to rebel. There were 40 of us, 43 of us in all. And all of our pictures, this is an interesting tale about the power of the press and or the lack of it, all of our pictures were put on page 5 of The Sun, 5, all in red mugshot together with our telephone numbers, our office telephone numbers, not our personal telephone numbers, but our office telephone numbers, and exhortations to The Sun's readership to phone up as many as possible of the supporting fellow travelling lefties. Not all of us were lefties, but these appalling people who are friends of terrorists, and tell them what you think of them, that they're going to vote against 42 days detention without trial. So we were worried about this. We were in the tea room. We knew it was coming, and we just had discussions about it. We issued instructions to our staff, who were going to have to field most of this. We arranged to be in the office ourselves in order to do it, awaiting this avalanche from the popular press. I received, because I was second on the list, I received more telephone calls than most. 3. Two people phoned up to tell me how much they supported the stance that we were taking. 42 days of detention, congratulations and stick to your guns. And one, who I recorded, I still have it recorded, one man, plainly drunk, phoned up in order to inquire why I was against 42 days quarantine for dogs, bringing their rabid illnesses over from Europe. And when I told him that, on the contrary, I was entirely in favour of 42 days quarantine for dogs, indeed I would increase the period of 42 days to 80 days. And when that, he became quite tearful on the phone and said that he would vote for me forever, notwithstanding the fact that he was a diehard Tory. So it's an interesting story that reflects on the power, or the presumed power, of the Murdoch press. And of course, many of the things that the government's tried to put through, I mean, are come through under a cloak. They are disguised. Identity cards was one. Identity cards, one of the things that I had the most difficulty with. I'm pleased to say that my constituents basically treated me with a certain amount of sympathetic consideration. And they were very good about the fact that I rebelled against my own government 167 times. And if that sounds impressive, it's nothing compared to Jeremy Corbyn's 214. But nonetheless, they were considerate about it. But the one I had most trouble with was identity cards. Because people would say, why can't I, what's wrong with an identity card? Why can't I carry an identity card? It's a useful, helpful thing. You can go and use it in the National Health Service. You can use it to identify yourself. You don't have to carry a driving license. And like, why? What's wrong with an identity card? And of course, that was exactly what the government was saying. This is exactly what you want. Terrifically useful thing. Your rights, for health, and all of those will be on this chip. Well, of course, there was nothing wrong with identity cards. What was wrong was the database that lay behind the identity cards. And the requirements of that database, which was a secret database to be kept on you in order to obtain your identity. Now, that was the vice behind it, and explaining that to constituents was not easy. I can remember an enormously respectable Labour voting, funnily enough, constituents of mine, obtained in a blazer and time with his wife, and and said, what was wrong with these identity cards? And I said, well, I explained what I've just explained to you. And I said, and the other thing is you do realise that the Act provides that there will be centres, explicit centres, set out around the country, one for every three or four constituencies, where you will have to go in order to have your personal verified. So you will sit in front of somebody, probably in a white coat, who will effectively record the colour of your eyes, the size of your head, at which point he looked slightly short. Are you sure? I said, yes, I am. I said, yes, I am. It's all there in the secondary legislation. All of your personal particulars. And Jenny said, well, she have to have her head measured. and I said, well, yes, I suppose so. He said, oh, dear. And so he was fine. So I advised him to go and spread the word. But not since the Doomsday Book would there ever have been requirements for British people to render themselves up to be counted and detained as there would have been under that legislation. Fortunately, it died. It died the death, not because we won the argument. It died the death because we won the argument on the money. I mean, and the money that would have been required in order to create this database was horrendous. And as at the same time, the computer systems and National Health Service were crashing at a net cost of nearly £10 billion to the taxpayer, they didn't want another computer scandal like that. So that's how we won it. But the point of the story about identity cards was the way in which it was presented to the people was a palpable fraud. A palpable fraud. And it is very difficult, unless you have the ear of the media, in order to say that. And that brings me to backbenchers and the media. Because the parliamentary process, which I'll come to in a moment, is unhappily not all that it should be. Because of the whipping system, the party system, the system of backbenchers, it is, and I'll come to why it is in a moment, and so on. So backbenchers, if they need to make an impact and stand up to the government, need the press. And of course, the government hate it. You are not supposed, you are forbidden as a Labour Party backbencher to go give stories to the press. Forbidden, it's written into your contract. Of course, technical men notice of it, and they would never sack you as a result of it because it would cause an outcry. But they hate the government, hate you. Of course, the government is manipulating the press itself. I mean, the idea that Mr. Alistair Campbell is in any way impeded by manipulating the press. I've sent the odd thing to the press, but never anything like the dodgy dossier. But they hate it. The problem is, of course, that you can't get into the media when you want to. The media come to you, you don't go to them. You can try, but you don't. And this I will illustrate by another short story, if I may, about the Iraq War. In the run-up to the Iraq War, I was desperate to get onto the media, any media at all, in order to express my opposition and the opposition of many of us on the backbenches of the Labour Party to what we regarded as an impending disaster. I'm pleased to say, well, I'm not pleased to say, I'm distraught to say that we were right. But that's nothing to the matter. At the time, I was desperate to get on to the press in order to try to do something about it. We were building up a good opposition in Parliament, and we nearly won, but the press was necessary. Could I get on? No, I could not. Why? I'll tell you. Because at the time, there, you may remember it, there was a trial taking place at the Old Bailey of a gentleman called Burrell. Burrell was Princess Diana's butler. There is a point to this story, bear with me. He was Princess Diana's butler, and after the death of Princess Diana, he was found to have a number of her personal belongings and impedimenta under a blanket in his garage. He was arrested and charged with stealing. And it was a big case. The Burrell case was a big case. Now, the editorial mind is large, but it is monocular. And so they sit down and they say at the editorial meetings, who do we know in Parliament who can talk on the Burrell case? Well, Marshall Andrews is a criminal barrister, that is to say a barrister that does crime. He's a criminal barrister. He's a Republican, so he can talk about the monarchy. So he is the man to deal with this butler, this case. And so whenever the phone went from Saturday programme or the Telegraph or whatever. And I said, oh, good, I really want to get on and talk about Iraq. And they said, no, well, fine, that's very helpful, we want, but we want you to talk about this butler. And then the Burrell case came to an end. It came to an end because Her Majesty the Queen woke up one morning and remembered that she had given Burrell permission to take these items of Princess Diana's. So that was relayed to the court, which was presided over by an old friend of Helena's and I, called Mrs. Justice, now Lady Justice Rafferty, Miss Justice Whiplash, as she was christened, by the son. And so the Queen's evidence was transported to her, and of course you can't call the Queen to be cross-examined in those circumstances. So Mr. Burrell was acquitted, much to the chagrin, I may say, of Mrs. Justice Whiplash. But he was. So I thought then, now I can get on to the media. And then, so, but at exactly the same time, contemporaneously, it was revealed that a number of the servants and butlers in Buckingham Palace were misbehaving themselves with each other in a sexual way. And so, the editorial mind is large, but it is monocular. So by that time, I had achieved a reputation of being the Member of Parliament to deal with butlers. This is true. And so after that, whenever the telephone went and said, oh, hello, Bob, this is new Channel 4, can you? And I said, yes, please, yes. I mean, I'm very, very worried about what's this truth real. And they said, what is fornicating flunkies that I was being called out in order to deal with. And this is a true story. Finally, I'd had enough of it. And on 5 Live phoned up one morning and said, would you come? And I had the usual palaver. And I said, no, they want me to talk about these butlers in Buckingham Palace. So I went on and I said, and you can get it on a podcast now. And they said, now Bob, they asked me a question. And I said, before you go any further, I said, I want you to know this, that fornication among royal footmen is almost unknown in Baghdad. But that is no reason to suppose that they have weapons of mass destruction. And he said, oh, well, thank you, Bob. those are the lengths to which it is necessary in order to get yourself onto the media. But to Parliament, why is it possible that decent, thoroughly decent members of Parliament allow themselves to be part of this process? I'm going to finish in just a very short while and have some questions. Why is it that they have? Well, it's because of the constituent parts of Parliament. We have in Parliament now a growing tendency towards professional politicians. That is to say, people who have no other career, want no other career than politics. They start as advisers to politicians or advisers to trade unionists or the like, and they move on from that into constituency office, into local party office, and then they move into the House of Commons. I was elected at the age of 53, and I was a blanket case compared to most of my colleagues that were elected at the same time, the average age of which was 31. Average age, so that means that there are a substantial number below that, and of course at 53 I pulled the average up, the mean average up, no end. So you can see the position. Now, I have nothing at all against the young, indeed I admire them enormously, but it is a truism that the older you are, the more experience you have. Doesn't mean it's good experience, and there are some very, very stupid old members of Parliament, and very, very clever young ones, so this is all of these generalisations. I mean, experience helps you a bit, particularly if it's experience which has rendered itself to profit and loss doing a job and the like. You get some experience from it. But that's not the real vice. The real vice is, in Parliament, that if you have only one job, that is the only career that you have. And if it's the only career that you have, it's the only career in which you can succeed. And you will not succeed in Parliament unless you do the will of the Whips. Unless you conform to your party discipline, you are finished in Parliament. So what that renders is, I mean, people like me, I mean, I like to say I don't care, I did care, I cared terribly about Parliament. But I had another career. I had another career behind me, which had been a reasonably successful career. And so the only career that I had was not something that was going to be taken away from me. So I have a certain amount of sympathy for my colleagues. And they know perfectly well that to have voted against the government on Iraq would be the mark of Cain. To vote against the government on control orders, to vote against the government on jury trial or the reduction or the abolition of jury trial is the mark of Cain. So you may not agree with it, you may not want to do it. But if you want a career, and it is the only career that you have, then you will perform it. Now, that is a byproduct. It's not in itself about civil liberties, but it's why these things happen. My own relationship with the Whips was dire, absolutely dire. Particularly one called Hilary Armstrong, who was the chief whip in my latter time. In Parliament, yes, indeed, poisonous woman, and absolutely corrupt. I was at the Labour Party conference in Bournemouth. I will finish with this short story. I was at the Labour Party conference in Bournemouth. I was on the Today programme. I'd been asked to go on to talk about, it was a terrorism issue, but they don't let you get away with it that easily, and there was a particular difficult spat going on between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown at the time. And at the end, when I was just about to go, John Humphreys said, "Oh, hang on, Bob, just let me answer this." And he said, "Well, what do you think, what do you make of this going on between these two most powerful men in Britain? I mean, how much longer can this go on?" And I said, "Well," I said, "John, my view, for what it is worth," and I still think it's possibly true, is this. I think we've got the best Chancellor of the Exchequer we've had for half a century, and the worst Prime Minister that we've had for a century and a half. He said, "Oh, that's interesting, Bob, that's fine, thank you very much." Anyway, a matter of hours later, I get a message from the Chief Whip's office, "Please come and see me as soon as possible. It's for me," which of course you do, of course I don't see you. And she sat down and she said, "Bob," she said, "Bob, how could you? How could you? We all know you're difficult, we all know you're odd, but how could you say that Tony is the worst Prime Minister for 150 years? And I said, "Well, Chief Whip," I said, I've been thinking about it. I said, it was very early in the morning. I said, it was a question that I was not prepared for, and on reflection, I think I'm wrong. I was wrong. I think, on reflection, you've got to go back to Wellington." history is not the Chief Whip's strong point. So she looked at me and she said, "Well, I wish you'd made that clear at the time." I don't want to leave you with a feeling of despondency. Things are getting much better. They are getting better. Parliament has taken much more control over its own business. Select committees are now much more powerful than they were. There are alternative means of preferment and success in Parliament. The record of this government is not great on civil liberties, but it is nowhere near as bad as before. And indeed, the Labour Party is reawakening to the fact that civil liberties may actually be an election winner rather than an election loser. So things are not bad. We had our victories. We had our victories on jury trial. We had our victories, for instance, on the glorification of terrorism, which was going to be put into a bill that was an offence for which you'd get 14 years in prison for glorifying terrorism, whether you intended to or not. Whether the act that you committed, whether you intended it to glorify, what did in fact glorify terrorism? Well, we won that one. We won that one by pointing out that glorification was a wonderful word in the hands of Blake or music of Handel, but it has no place in the criminal justice system. We don't do beatitudes in the Old Bailey, as we pointed out at the time. And also, much more significantly, it was pointed out that Cherie Blair herself could be arrested because in an ill-advised moment when she had been visiting the medical aid for Palestine, she had said that she could only have sympathy with Palestinian, young Palestinian suicide bombers who could deemed to be helpless and hopeless in the situation that they were. Glorification of terrorism, yes indeed it most certainly is. Sherry Blair, 14 years, there you are. That's it. So we won that one. So thank you very much indeed for inviting me. It is getting better. It is not a matter of total lamentation at the moment. And one must always bear in mind the words of our greatest ever poet, Kipling, when he said, if you can keep your head, when all about you are losing theirs, then you have seriously underestimated the gravity of the situation.
Splendid. Now, I'm sure that some of you would like to press a question upon our guest. There we are.
Thanks very much for a marvellous talk, and it's very funny as well, it's good. What I want to ask is, when you were selected, did the whips intervene and say, this man should never be selected?
They didn't, because they didn't know at the time. They did attempt to have me deselected. Not directly and expressly, but there was certainly within my constituency party, there were people, of course, didn't like me, didn't agree with what I was doing, and so they definitely were approached by the whips in order to move a re-selection, and that does happen. But generally speaking, they stay out. And if you have a reasonably high profile, that of course is a defence in itself, because it's quite difficult if all your only sins are sins of principle, or at least simply that you can say a principle, and I think that they were quite difficult for them to do anything about you. What does happen, when immediately after I was elected, Mr. Peter Mandelson left somebody said the other day, the man who put the enema into Enigmatic. Peter Mandelson left the celebration early. I mean, in order to draw up a list which was headed members to be seen. Now, that didn't mean that you were chosen to be seen to be with a view to preferment. And I was on it. There were another 20 or 30 people on that list. Some of whom ironically did rather well after that, but that is the kind of thing. Now that was leaked. That list was leaked to the Sunday Times. Who leaked it? Well, I tell you who leaked it. Peter Mandelson leaked it. That's it. Now this is the way the system works. That's it. So of course, nobody was going to be seen. But what was necessary was that out in the open should be the fact that you were marked. You were watched. At that stage, I said to the Telegraph, were decent enough to give me an award afterwards, and I said, the Sunday Times, they had no idea the danger and damage that they do by publishing things like that. I know members of Parliament who were practically in tears when they realised their name wasn't on it.
There is a gentleman.
Thank you very much, and you're a great storyteller, and I hope to nick some of your good techniques. But as a journalist, I have to retaliate a little bit about the Butler story. I mean, you're right to poke at the media and their failings and things, but on the Iraq War, I mean, it is a serious issue. If Brown had taken his men with him, and he was very late in deciding, wouldn't the House have voted against that action? And Chris Mullin actually did vote and became a minister. So, it's not all the end if people go with their convictions.
Chris, I think I am right in saying, voted against on one vote, which was the vote beforehand. He abstained on the final vote. come. That is just simply a question. I'm a friend of his, and I mean, he did. All we needed was abstentions. Mm-hmm. True. Mm-hmm. I mean, in order to get there. Had Brown come out, yes, we would have won. I mean, he had enough people that were loyal to him that if he had signaled that he. Of course, it would have been the end of his time in cabinet. He couldn't possibly have stayed in the cabinet in those circumstances, even given the state of the cabinet at the time.
But he was playing with his opinion. He was very late in deciding.
He was. Pusillanimous. I mean, I admire Gordon Brown in many, many ways, far more than I do Tony Blair. But yes, no, it was pusillanimous. I mean, we were 13 votes short. I mean, even now, when I occasionally read my own book, which you'd never do, I have a great feeling of, you know, sadness when I read those chapters about the attempts to get that vote out. And we could have done so. Yes, I mean, your criticism of Gordon is absolutely, absolutely well-founded and well-made. And the mitigation for Gordon, in many cases, is this. He's a driven politician. He's a neurotic politician, a very neurotic politician indeed. And his driving force behind Gordon, as Helena knows, is poverty and child poverty. That's what makes him a politician. It is absolute racial detriment. And on that, on a national and international basis, he has done quite extraordinarily well. Probably no one in the world, no Protestant in the world has done as well as that. And the reason why Brown never came out and left is because he knew that if he did leave the cabinet, then that whole programme that he had would just simply have fallen apart. Now that's the mitigation, but it is only mitigation. It's not a defence to the indictment at all.
And here?
Thank you very much. I've long been an admirer of yours and this was fantastic. I've really enjoyed it. The only thing that I'm worried about is this, that you think it's getting better. I think a lot of us who are on the, you know, protest against this government that we've got are not at all convinced about this. I mean, I get these emails all the time about this bill that's going through that's going to prevent people having freedom of speech before the election and therefore, you know, making it easier for the Tories to have a nice ride in. And then there's the other thing that we all feel very much, that we're very much watched in our protests now. And there was this terrible story about the police trying to pay a student in Cambridge in order to denounce people in his protest group to the police. And then there's the whole business of drones. I had a big argument with David Aronovich about drones because he said, oh, well, you know, they're effective and ethical, effective. And I said, well, you know, there was somebody arrested on a terrorism charge in Birmingham the other day, and he will presumably be brought to court. But wouldn't it have been easier just to send in a drone and get rid of him? At that point, there was, some people started to think. So I'm not sure about this getting better. If you can really reassure me on that, that would be interesting.
I'm so pleased that you took on David Aronovich. I don't know about that. when I say it's getting better, I mean we are here on a relative scale. I was in Parliament and it was very, very bad. I mean, every Queen's speech that we went to, and Helena backed this up, there was a raft of measures. Over 500 new offences were created in the course of that time, and that's the ones that if we hadn't won some of it, there would have been infinitely more. It was a very, very bad time indeed, and the culture of it was very bad. The best supporter that we had in the House on all of this in the House was David Davis, who was Shadow Home Secretary. And it's a very great pity that he's not Home Secretary, because he is a genuine civil libertarian. So it's only a matter of relativity, and I agree with you entirely about the bill that you are talking about, which will circumscribe comment before an election. I think it's very unlikely that it will become law, actually, because the whole of the mass press is raged against it. It's quite difficult when that happens to Parliament to push it through. The most dangerous stuff that's going through is data. And the provision for the collection and retention of data, which is going through, I mean, it has gone through the House. Now, that is serious, because it's beginning to look very much like the identity cards. But again, the most difficult thing out there to win the public hearts and minds on that kind of thing, because the answer that you get all the time, as you know, on your campaigning is, if I have got nothing to fear, why should I be bothered about my identity being... Well, I mean, they could have said that in East Germany and in the Stasi, couldn't they? I mean, you've got nothing to fear. But, of course, quite a lot of us have got something to fear. It doesn't mean that it's criminal. I mean, but it means that we have views, we have ideas, which may be... and I don't trust the state. Never have done. And my time in Parliament did nothing to dissuade me of that. So I don't want to suggest that it all is well. It most certainly is not. But the avalanche of legislation has receded. And control orders themselves have been very largely ameliorated now. And detention without trial, 28 days, is not actually used anymore. So there is a momentum, I think the right way. But it's certainly this assault on civil liberties has not stopped.
Thank you. First of all, the gentleman behind, and then Stephen. Gentleman there. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for this talk. I'm not exaggerating when I say this is probably one of the best talks I've been to during my time in Oxford, honestly. I study parliaments and party voting or voting behaviour of MPs, and so please forgive me if I ask two questions, very brief ones. So the first one basically...
Don't put them in your exams,
I'm beyond exams, luckily. So the first question is, from your experience, if you make it onto the metaphorical blacklist of the whip or the party, is it more the frequency of dissent or more sort of the salience of a few big issues that you vote against, or is it I don't know, the situation of the day, the majority or whatever, or is it sort of an accumulation of the three? How do you get picked up by the whip? If you're not as, I mean, with your 167 votes or whatever you said, it's kind of hard to miss you. But
the answer is actually in an accumulation of bad behaviour. I mean, the truth is, when I said that you vote against which you lose your career, that is a slight overstatement. Most dogs are allowed one bite, literally. And then they have to dress it up, and then they apologise to the whips and all this, and then you can get away with one. Serial rebellion, you don't. And I would not have been a serial rebel if it hadn't been for the civil liberties issue and the wars. I mean, I'm not a natural anarchist, and I'm a natural Labour supporter, have been all my life, and it was only this that did it. But repeat offending of that kind, and you're out. I mean, you are out on your neck. Even at the end of the Blair period, when they were frankly like the Third Reich, they were appointing almost anybody that could walk into junior government office by that stage. So a very nice story about a junior chap who'd just been appointed as a junior minister in the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries or something. And somebody said to his wife, "Did you ever in your wildest dreams think your husband would be a minister?" And she thought about it and said, "My husband doesn't appear in my wildest dreams."
So very briefly, just the second question. You said that voting, if you vote with your principles and you vote against the party line, it's accepted, or you can at least look at yourself in the mirror because you voted on your principles. But then would there also be situations where someone would cultivate that image of a rebel for different reasons but to vote with their principles? I'm thinking, I don't know how the public in Britain react to, but whether they actually follow what you do in Parliament, but would it be to create a personal vote, as they call, for example?
Oh, I think that there is. You know, I mean, and certainly the press always suspect. I mean, that there is a meretricious element in a lot of rebellion. People are doing it because it's the way in which you get noticed. And I think, to be frank, yes, I mean, one or two of my colleagues, I have no intention of naming them, I mean, I think actually did enjoy it. Enjoy it very much. I can honestly hand on heart say I did not. I voting against your own, I've been a member of the Labour Party for 45 years or something. It's my party. And I believe fundamentally in the Labour Party, and I believe that it's been the greatest engine, political engine, for the advancement of social conditions of working people in the world ever. And it's been copied throughout. So I never enjoyed rebelling against my own party. Never. But I think the answer to your question is yes, I think there's something to do.
The forces that you were raging against, the Blair blanket straw axis, I just wanted to ask you what you felt drove them. You said it was authoritarian personalities. There was also, I guess, the shock of 9/11 and the fear of terrorism. Do you think they were more driven by fear, by what was it in their personalities that made them tread the path that they took?
I think with David Blunkett, I mean, David Blunkett is a very, very complex man. You can take him or leave him. I mean, I personally, we didn't get on at all. But he's a very complex individual. He is a natural authoritarian. It's tempting to say that has got something to do with his blindness. He has been metaphorically in a prison all his life. There is an element of bitterness about Blunkett, and I think even his greatest friends and admirers would admit that the case. But he is a natural authoritarian. Blair as well. And he's control man, believes in control, endemically. In part, that goes back, to be fair, to those days in the Labour Party, where every Labour Party conference had blood all over the floor, and the discipline raged everywhere. So they perceived the need to take a bit of control, and I don't disagree with them about that. But it's a natural instinct, and Brown's well, I mean, there's a sort of gloomy man's side to Gordon Brown. So they did have it behind them naturally. But I think the real driving force was power. And this perception, as I was saying, that one of the really serious problems, lacunas of the Labour Party, was the image of being soft on crime. Which the Tories hung around our necks and did it beautifully, absolutely beautifully. And it was a deliberate attempt to outflank and ambush them. And then, of course, it took hold, because then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then you've got the relationship with Merkel, who is a natural authoritarian, I mean, in spades. And the relationship, let's keep leaving the relationship with Murdoch for the moment, but I mean, this was a very clammy, very close relationship, and a dangerous one. So that sort of symbiosis was what operated, I think.
You mentioned the issue of MPs not having other experience, which the electorate can see as being quite an issue because they don't really know terribly much about life, and you explained why you think that is. Can you see any solution to that? Because we're not empowered to do anything about it.
Not immediately, no. I can't see any solution to it. And although some things are getting better, I think in a sense this is getting rather worse. One of the reasons is because I think that there is what psychiatrists and lawyers call a crisis of self-esteem. In Parliament and parliamentarians. If you listen to them, they are perpetually apologising for themselves and saying we got it wrong. The idea that they're not is a myth. Even in government, saying that we've got to listen to the people. There's far too much of that going on, in my view. I mean, politicians are there in order to lead and take a point. I mean, they're not there in order to take a straw poll. I mean, every single time they are. But there is a crisis of self-esteem. Undoubtedly, which probation officers understand very well. And it's the handmaiden of crime, funnily enough. I mean, the wretched, tawdry, dreadful business of expenses was linked to this. It was late. I mean, some of it was serious, about a dozen cases were serious, the vast majority of it was petty beyond belief. And it's that kind of pettiness which we see in the criminal law, which is linked to this lack of self-esteem. Now, and politicians are held in very poor regard, not terribly poor regard, but pretty poor, and that is the fault of the press in many ways. I mean, and quite, in many ways, quite unfairly as well, because most politicians are not very good, but they're pretty straight, and they work very hard. But the lack of self-esteem is there. Now, it's a rather long way of saying this. If you're going to attract people into Parliament, you've got to increase that. You've got to increase, status is a poor word, but you've got to make people think that if I go in there, I can make a difference because of the position that I will hold. Not that I want aggrandizement or anything else, but because of the position that I hold, I will be able to. I will be able to contribute. Now, people don't feel that anymore. I mean, you know, so people that have got successful careers, very unlikely to trade them for the misery of the whips. And they'll trade them for government, and this leads to another problem. I mean, I say this with deference to Helena, who absolutely deserved her ennoblement more than anybody else that I know. But because of what is happening in Parliament, the way that you get distinguished people into office now as you promote them through the Lords.
And they are straight into the cabinet.
And then you create a cabinet of Lords, and that, a few, is fine. Mm. But if it gets, if it goes down through the ranks, very bad idea indeed, because they don't have constituencies, of course. Mm. So there isn't that direct responsibility. So it's a very long way of answering your question, and it comes down to saying, I don't think it is getting any better. But you're going to have to do something serious about the status of members of Parliament before it will. And that, I think, means actually radically altering the Constitution. And here we are into another much longer argument. I don't see the cabinet system being viable for very much longer. The cabinet system is grotesquely abused now. Grotesquely. We have a presidential system in the United Kingdom, and we might as well be honest about it. You know, the power that we invoke in our prime ministers is far greater than the power that's possessed by American presidents. In truth, I mean, when you analyse it, but there's none of the checks and balances, because in America, of course, you've got the checks and balances in Congress, and you do not pick your cabinet from Congress. Congress is there specifically in order to control the executive. Whereas in our system, of course, you pick your cabinet from the very people who are there to control you.
So it holds them in.
Yeah, and so the conflict is immediately apparent. Now we're ranging onto much wider. Interesting.
There's a hand there.
Okay. Quite a lot of what your talk was really involved your relationship with the press and the media. So I'm very curious to know what you, as a civil libertarian, feel about regulation of the press, or attempts to regulate it post-Levinson, and indeed measures that have already been taken, I think, in some small regard.
Instinctively, I dislike them. That is a matter of instinct. And I don't like feeling that, because I think in many areas we've got a pretty rotten press in this country. I mean, in many areas, not everywhere, there are some very good newspapers, but there are some stinkers. And of course, what came out with Murdoch was something that we all knew was happening, but hacking was it was a bit like Al Capone and tax evasion. Hacking was the least of what they were doing. It what brought about the downfall and the closure of the News of the World, but compared to the malign influence which was being exercised, particularly by the Murdoch press, on government and at the heart of government, hacking was absolutely nothing. And more important was what was revealed in the relationship between Rebecca Brooks and Cameron. Well, that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world, in truth, where you have people saying, I cried when I heard your speech, and can I borrow your horse? And it's a dreadful, clammy relationship, right at the heart of a very powerful news organization. So, but for all of that, I am instinctively against regulation. And that for the same reason that I just said, that I distrust the state. I do, and I distrust the state more than I distrust the press. And also I think they're not as powerful as people think they are. I mean, and they think they are. And the story about the three phone calls and the quarantine dog is a perfectly good case in point. I mean, they do not wield, particularly the tabloid press. I mean, British people are not stupid. I mean, and an awful lot of them. You tend to look at the front of the Daily Mail and you think, good Lord, isn't that awful? 4 million people think what's on the front of the Daily Mail. They don't. Daily Mail readers don't buy it anymore. I mean, some of them do, and they're more likely to buy it than most of them are deeply sceptical. They know what the Daily Mail is, they know its views. So, I mean, broadly speaking, I'm against it. Self-regulation, yes. A proper form of self-regulation, absolutely. What is being put forward at the moment, press is not bad, it's an improvement on the old council. But I think that that's as far as we ought to go.
Any other question, or shall we say thank you? That was